From the CQ Roll Call Newsroom in Washington, this is the Week Ahead podcast, your nonpartisan news source for how Congress and the federal government shape the real world. I'm Sean Zeller, and in this, our last podcast of 2017, I'll talk with two Roll Call politics reporters, Bridget Bowman and Simone Pathé, about what the policymaking that's occurred in Washington this year means for the politics of 2018, when all 435 House seats and 34 in the Senate are up for grabs. Welcome to the show, Bridget and Simone.
Thanks. Thank you.
All right, Bridget. Republicans are leaving town for Christmas with their first big legislative victory, a tax bill. How is it playing with the voters?
Well, there's been some polling to suggest that the parts of the bill are unpopular with voters, but at this point, we don't know so far out from the 2018 elections, what are voters going to be thinking about when they go into their polling places? We do know that Republicans saw this tax bill as sort of do or die for them heading into the midterms, that if they didn't get this done, it was going to be very hard to make a case to voters that they should keep control of Congress and when they couldn't get some of their major legislative accomplishments done.
Okay. And Bridget, the Speaker, Paul Ryan, has been talking about how people are going to see the effect of this tax bill come February. That's because human resources departments are going to adjust their payroll tax withholding. And most Americans are going to see a reduction in their taxes in February, less money coming out. Might that affect the way Americans see the tax bill?
It could, if you see an immediate impact of that. Important to note that some of those individual aspects are not permanent, and that might be part of the conversation as Democrats try and point out the ramifications of this tax bill, too. So it's just
but
a
that's
little,
way down the road,
exactly.
2025, no, right? They expire.
Right, that's a good point. So we'll just have to see sort of who gets the tax cut, sort of what it means when people go to file their tax returns, and are they thinking about that when they go to vote in November?
Mm-hmm. Okay, Simone. So a tax bill certainly is a big legislative victory for Republicans during a year in which they've really struggled to pass major legislation. And so they're quite pleased with themselves about it. But what does history show about how voters see major legislation like this? Does it always lead to big success at the ballot box?
Not necessarily. I think it really depends on the kind of legislation. For Republicans, as Bridget said, it was really do or die, not so much to get something done on taxes specifically, but to get something, really anything, passed. If you recall, they failed to pass the health care overhaul through the House and the Senate. That was something they had campaigned on for 7 years. So it was really about just proving to voters that they were able to achieve something so that then when they go home, especially next summer, right before the elections, they don't go home empty-handed, effectively.
Right. Now, the tax bill passed on a party line. Democrats voted against it. That seems, history shows that voters aren't that keen on partisan legislation. We only need to go back to 2010 when the Democrats had passed the Obamacare health care legislation on a party line and were punished for it severely at the ballot box in 2010. So can we draw any conclusions from that?
I think it depends how this is going to get messaged. You know, both parties really see this as a winning opportunity for them. Democrats think that this is just a golden opportunity to point out that Republicans are actually raising some taxes, which goes against their messaging for years, and that this will hurt the middle class. Republicans, of course, argue that this is a boon for the middle class. So I don't think voters will care so much about, you know, whether it was one party or the other that was able to pass this. It's really about how they perceive the messaging around it.
Okay, Bridget, back to you. You were down in Alabama recently for the special election there, the special Senate election to fill the seat of former Senator Jeff Sessions. A Democrat won for the first time in more than a generation in Alabama, a very Republican state. So, and at the same time, we had a recent special election, not a special election, a regular routine election in Virginia where the governorship went to the Democrats and Democrats picked up a lot of state legislative seats. So Democrats are seeing this as a harbinger for 2018. Is that fair?
Well, certainly fair to say that Democrats looked at Alabama and were very excited about the results. We saw sort of a barrage of fundraising emails coming after Doug Jones won, saying nothing's off limits, like now we can go to Texas and win. I think there is a certain sort of reality check that's needed, too, in terms of the unique vulnerability that Roy Moore brought to the Senate race in Alabama.
Right. He was accused of molesting teenage girls.
Right. And if you look at the results of the Alabama Senate race, the number of people who wrote in a candidate actually slightly exceeded Doug Jones' margin of victory. So theoretically, those were votes that might have gone to Roy Moore in a normal type of situation. I do think there are things that Democrats are looking at what Doug Jones was able to do and trying to see if they can apply those to other races, particularly in the South, when it comes to turning out African-American voters, really having a robust ground game there, and talking, having a candidate who was rooted in Alabama who could talk about some of the more maybe mundane policy issues, as some might look at them. But he sort of looked at them as trying to focus on issues that affect Alabama. And certainly Democrats are looking at that and trying to see how they can apply that to other mm-hmm. races, too.
Now, the minority vote, particularly the black vote, was very important in Barack Obama's two presidential elections. It was very strong in Alabama and in Virginia, right, which was unusual for non-presidential years.
Right. Yeah, it was very high, particularly in Alabama. 30% of the electorate was turned out were African-American voters. They only comprise nearly 25% of registered voters in Alabama. So you saw definitely a high turnout there and other places as well. Important to note, in some of these Senate races where Democrats are either defending seats or where they're looking to be on offense, you don't have as high of minority voters populations like in North Dakota or Nebraska or West Virginia. Maybe those lessons can't be applied there, but certainly in other House districts and Senate races, you can try and apply some of those lessons.
Okay, Bridget, one more question on that those two elections. What was the turnout like in rural Alabama and rural Virginia, white sections of the state? Now, those sections were the ones that went very strongly for President Trump, and the Republican theory has been that those voters are particularly motivated. Did they show up in Alabama and Virginia?
Yeah. So the Alabama, the turnout overall was 40%, which was double what it was for the primary and for the runoff. So you saw overall a higher turnout. But I think in Alabama particularly, Roy Moore had less of a campaign structure than the Jones team had. So it's sort of difficult to look at his outreach and apply it sort of more broadly. I think it'd be interesting to see how Republicans are trying to turn out these Trump-based voters in sort of a more normal environment, if that makes sense. And he also relied a lot on the church networks in Alabama to try and turn out voters, which his campaign argued was a key part of their ground game. But I'm not sure if other candidates will take the same route.
Okay, Simone, back to you. Now, in advance of the 2016 presidential election, the Republicans did some soul searching, and they put out a paper that said basically they needed to do more to reach out to a broader swath of the electorate, particularly Hispanics. Now, of course, President Trump totally ignored that advice and still won election. But the theory was that the demographics of the country are changing and that demographics are destiny. But it seems that Trump's victory and now these victories for Democrats in Alabama and Virginia indicate something else, that perhaps what's important is which side of the country is angriest and therefore comes and turns out to vote. Are the political experts rethinking what our destiny is as a country in terms of who's going to win elections going forward?
Yeah, I think that's always been somewhat the case. If you remember back to 2010, when the Tea Party movement was really on fire, the folks who came out to vote were responsible for toppling very established Republican senators and House members. And it was this very angry movement that no one really saw coming. No one expected Dave Brat to unseat Eric Cantor. But it was angry people, like you say.
Or Scott Brown to win a Senate seat in Massachusetts.
There you go. Right. Another example. So again, I think it'll depend on messaging and how both parties are able to really motivate their base, but also talk to persuadable voters. But the base for Republicans is an especially important question going into 2018, because as you alluded to earlier, Trump had this special coalition of white angry voters. We don't know if they're going to come out again. You know, 2016 in many ways was an anomaly. He's not on the ballot this year, so there's no guarantee that congressional candidate X with an R next to his name is going to benefit from the same kind of angry, motivated base that Donald Trump did last fall.
Right. The Republicans are hoping that kind of anti-establishment fervor that led to Trump's victory persists in 2018. But what we've seen in this intervening year, 2017, is that Democrats are really pissed off and are coming out to vote in high numbers, and that they may be the angrier side in 2018.
Certainly. Just looking at the number of candidates who have already announced by this point in the cycle, I mean, usually we're just starting to hear about candidates now who are getting interested in running for House races. But we've got candidates who have been in the race for 6 months, and they're raising, you know, $500,000 a quarter, often outraising the incumbents.
Right. The Democratic recruitment arm bringing in candidates who are raising a lot of money is unprecedented.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's think about 2018. We've got another full year where Congress can get to work and pass policy. We haven't heard much other than perhaps that they're talking about entitlement reform, which is quite striking. It's considered the third rail of politics, certainly something you don't touch during election years. We're talking about Social Security and Medicare. So, Bridget, are they really going to attempt a reform of entitlement?
We'll have to see how they navigate that one. I think typically it's tougher to get things done in Congress in an election year. People want to be back home campaigning. Also important to note that depending the process that they use, that anything that goes through the Senate is going to need some Democrat to overcome the filibuster rule. And with Doug Jones coming, that becomes even a tougher task for Senate Republicans to try and get that threshold. So we'll just have to see kind of how they navigate and what Republicans who are in charge think would be a good idea heading into 2018.
Right. To touch Social Security, to reform Social Security, they would have to get Democratic votes because the procedures they've been using this year on the tax reform, which allow a simple majority, are not allowed when you're talking about Social Security. Is that right?
Yeah, I think any other big pieces of legislation, if they don't go through that same process, they're certainly going to need some Democrats.
Okay. And Simone, Donald Trump, you mentioned he's not on the ballot in 2018, but he casts a long shadow. I mean, he's been a huge personality. He's shaking things up in Washington this year. I would imagine he is going to be on the ballot box in a metaphorical sense in 2018. Mm-hmm. So are Democrats planning to run against him, and are Republicans planning to run with him, or is it some of each?
I think it's going to be some of each, depending on the district, depending on the state. Remember that a lot of Democrats at the Senate level who are up for re-election are in states that Trump won, and he won by really big margins. I mean, we're talking like 30 to 40 points here. So they have to run somewhat close to him just to appeal to some of his voters, to get enough crossover voters so that they are able to get re-elected. In other places, at the House level, for example, it's a little bit different. You've got moderate Republicans like Carlos Curbelo, for example, from Florida, who's been very outspoken, who even mentioned the word impeachment at one point about the president. He knows that he has to distance himself from the president to win re-election in a Clinton district.
Right. There were 24, I think, House districts where a Republican was elected to the House, but the voters preferred Hillary Clinton. 23. So that's, if the Democrats were to win all of those, they would come very close to a majority.
Right. Just one shy.
So, Simone, you mentioned all these Democratic candidates who are coming out to run, but Republicans also have to worry about primary challenges, right? There's this Trump group out there that's upset with many of the current Republicans in Congress and may run primary challenges to them. So it's another potential threat to Republican electability.
Yeah, definitely. In many states, we're seeing that primary contests are really more of a Trump loyalty contest. I just got a press release a few minutes ago from a candidate in Indiana running for Senate, saying that his opponent is not with Donald Trump.
Right. And Luther Strange, of course, was the preferred Republican candidate of the establishment Republicans in Alabama, but he lost to Roy Moore, the candidate who promised to shake things up more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in many ways, he was actually more of the Trump-like candidate, even though he didn't actually run with the official backing of the president.
Okay. And Bridget, over to you. Democrats may be a bit overconfident based on their wins in Virginia and Alabama. Are there things they need to be wary of going into 2018 in the politics?
Sure. So the primary scenario is something that we see on the Democratic side, too, especially on the House side. You have a number of seats that should be competitive for Democrats that have like seven or so candidates running. And the concern there is that will the candidate that is farther to the left win the primary, and then that makes them less palatable to general election voters, and we're going to have to see how Democrats navigate that as well. Important to note, too, that Democrats are very optimistic about taking back the House. They need 24 seats to do so. On the Senate side, they now, with Doug Jones winning, they only need 2 seats to win back the Senate. And Arizona and Nevada seem like their top targets for Republican seats. But on the Senate side, Democrats are also largely on defense. They're defending more seats than they're targeting. So they also have to sort of navigate that. And as Simone mentioned, especially those senators running in states that Trump won.
Right. They're running in some states that went very strongly for Trump, like West Virginia and North Dakota.
Right.
All right. Well, thank you, Simone, and thank you, Bridget, for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Sean Zeller. Thank you for joining us. We're taking a week off, but we'll be back on January 5th with a new and improved podcast, CQ on Congress. You can subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and on NPR One. And for more on this and other stories, visit rollcall.com or find us on Twitter at CQNow or at Roll Call.